Change happens. How we respond to change can make or break us and our careers. Join us for an intimate insight into how influential and authentic people lead through change. The good, the bad, and everything in between. Because whether we like it or not, change happens.
Hi, I'm Janelle McMaster, and welcome to the Change Happens podcast. Conversations with influential leaders on leading through change and the lessons learned along the way. Today, I'm joined by the Right Honourable Lord Mayor of Melbourne, Sally Capp, the first directly elected female Lord Mayor, who leads the portfolio for city transport, infrastructure and operations in Aboriginal Melbourne. Sally began her career as a solicitor, serving both large corporates and entrepreneurial endeavours, including launching a funds management business, which then went on to list on the Australian Stock Exchange. Having worn several hats throughout her career, in 2018, she decided to dedicate herself to public services driven by her experience in business, her understanding of how to get things done, and her passion to work on behalf of the city she loves. Awarded the McKinnon Emerging Political Leader of the Year in 2019, Sally was the first woman to hold the post of Agent General for Victoria in the UK, Europe and Israel. And she's also well known for being the first female member of the Collingwood Football Club Board. As you can hear, she's a person of many firsts. In this episode, we explore how this trailblazing Lord Mayor is creating change and the lessons she's learned along the way, including over the last 18 months, which has been a particularly critical time in the City of Melbourne's history with the influence of COVID-19. Lots to get into, so let's do exactly that. Well, Sally, as I mentioned in that intro, Melburnians have certainly been through a lot during COVID as the city's most locked down city in the world. How have you been handling that as a citizen of Melbourne, and how are you handling that as a leader of Melbourne?
Wow, that's a really big question to start, Janelle. Thank you.
Didn't ease you into it, did I?
No, I love it. Let's jump straight in. It's been extreme. I think for so many people, we're going through a set of circumstances that we haven't experienced in our lifetime, and that saying that there isn't a playbook for this is something that's really resonated in many conversations that I've had personally as well as professionally. From a personal perspective, I'm really lucky that I'm not just a glass half full sort of person. I'm a glass all the way full sort of person, and I tend towards the optimistic. But really, I tend towards the things that I can control and that I can do, and that gives me a sense of progress and a sense of purpose. And even small achievements day to day really counted for a lot during COVID. I think that personal approach is very much at the centre of how I've gone about leading during this experience. I know there's the word authentic that some people think is overused, but I really feel leaders that are authentic are people that I'm drawn towards because it gives everybody permission to be themselves, to bring their talents and their skills, their experiences, but also to be able to say, I don't know, I'm not sure, I think I've got it wrong. I find that that approach is also much better in circumstances where if we don't have a playbook, let's face it, whatever we do has risks, is a trial, could be a pilot, it's experimenting, it's exploring, and being able to be open to failure and respect that, as well as, of course, striving for success, is really important in these sorts of environments. So from my perspective as a leader, it's to be to acknowledge that it's tough, to represent the very desperate and devastating times that people have been experiencing, but to be positive and proactive in identifying ways forward. And literally every extra person that we could help each day, each small step towards a better outcome has been something that I've held on to make sure I can stay motivated and focused.
I love that. It's a really wonderful blend of authentically and empathically leaning into the experience that is, whilst focusing on the really proactive steps that one can take to move forward. I love that. And we will come back to some of the initiatives that you focused on in Melbourne, but I'd like to take a step back and look at your formative years, where I know that you spent time in your early childhood in Papua New Guinea. Why was that, and what was it like?
Well, I admire my parents so much for being adventurous. They've been adventurous in many different ways, but one of them was literally the day after they got married, they jumped on a plane to a place called Papua New Guinea. And I think that sense of adventure and of risk-taking, frankly, and excitement about the unknown is something that's really resonated strongly with me and my siblings. We left there when I was five, so I really was very young, but I have some very strong memories of time in Rabaul, an island called Great New Britain, and very tropical, very exotic, a wonderful childhood. But I also remember clearly some of the turbulence and some of the confusion and aggression that happened as Australia started to transition out of that area and New Guinea was moving to self-governance. And it was a really confronting time, but I think a very important time. So I have very strong memories of that as well.
Yeah, I'm sure I know it's a young age when you left there, but no doubt the experiences and the feelings, you would have had a really strong sense of what was happening around you, which no doubt played forward. Now, upon coming back to Australia, you developed a love of sport and were part of a mixed football team in Melbourne's eastern suburbs. In hindsight, how do you think that has influenced roles that you subsequently took on in adult life? And I can't help but think of the fact that you're the first female on the Collingwood Football Club board. Was it your own personal experience of sport that led you that way?
Yes, well, there's a phrase, I guess thinking of it now, it's a bit of an old-fashioned phrase, which is to be a tomboy. Mm-hmm. I was certainly considered one of those. But I think it was more that I grew up in an environment where you should just have a go at everything. Mm. And I'm a serial have-a-goer. And
that
has led to some very humiliating moments as well, Janelle, but it has helped me to push my own personal boundaries but also to push the boundaries of environments and structures that I've worked within particularly. And it's really stood me in good stead. So if there was a football game happening, guess what? I wanted to be part of it. If it was, a game of hopscotch or it was a maths competition or drum band, I put my hand up for drum band as well in primary school. All of those things, to me, if they seemed interesting and it was possible, then I got involved.
How did you get over the humiliating moments? How do you brush yourself off from that sort of thing and keep going?
Look, it's really led to a good respect for failure because from those humiliating moments have come the most illuminating moments about myself, about other people, about organisations, about society. And I really see it as accelerated learning, even if it's learning the hard way. And it has stood me in good stead throughout my career. It's not that I rush towards failure or humiliation, but I'm not daunted by it either. So I have that healthy respect, as I said. I've had failures and I've had challenges personally and professionally, and I look at those as very much as turning points in my life. I had an experience with cancer in 2006, and that was a pivotal time for me to move into a different type of work. I've had experiences in the business world that have been harsh. And from those, though, I've really always used those experiences to help either accelerate or leap forward from there rather than look back. In fact, one of the most interesting experiences I had that is imprinted in my memories is when I was doing some work in Israel and I sat down with one of the very successful venture capitalists there, and I had a pitch deck talking about how successful I was and all of the credentials for concept I had. And his first question, he actually interrupted my presentation and said, "Can you tell me about your best five failures?"
Oh, wow.
And I had to sit back and I was flummoxed. I was not prepared for that. And I asked him why, and he said he really likes to back people that have shown the resilience that comes from failure, the learnings that come from failure. And he always asks that question because he knows that there'll be more determination, that people can identify better workarounds, that they're better at pivoting, which I now call pirouetting, and that they don't see barriers as full stops. They see them really as opportunities to keep evolving and changing, twisting and turning to something that's better. And it's always stuck with me that it's not just me who can value my own failures, but it's actually others that can value them as well.
I love that. And actually, I'd spent some time in Silicon Valley in that moment when you could travel a couple of years ago, and they had the same philosophy around not backing people unless they've had, you know, some serious amount of failures to clock up experiences. There's something really in that. And do you remember, Sally, when you were in that interview, any of the failed experiences that you spoke of? Is there one that comes to mind from you that's formed an indelible lesson learned that you've then taken forward?
Yeah, there are a lot, Janelle, but one that really sticks out for me is when I did leave the law and I partnered with a former client to set up what I call an adventure capital company. It was so far up the risk profile. It wasn't just venture, it was adventure. I walked around town looking for investors or seeking investors, and I went to people initially who I'd worked with previously, and so I felt confident that they understood my capabilities and that they would be sort of warm targets, if you like, for my initial investors. After a few of those meetings and, frankly, my first few no's, mm-hmm. I realized that I was moving into something completely different, and yet I was still relying on my experiences and the skills I'd developed as a lawyer to take me on that bridge to something new. And that just wasn't enough. And they were really good sorts of slaps across the face, because people wanted to support me, but I wasn't mitigating myself as a risk to them by having a more thoughtful business plan, by really identifying what the risks were and discussing what the mitigating effects could be or the workarounds might be, by building in some measures to de-risk their investment with me, which can go to structure, it can go to terms, it could go to what's in your constitution, or it could go to what's in your shareholders agreement. All of the things I should have been thinking about, but I was really being assumptive about how people saw me and not putting in the right work to, as I say, mitigate myself as a risk. So when I say and I encourage others to take risks, really the first step is to put a different perspective, to be more empathetic, if you like, but to put on the lens of the investor or the stakeholder or the customer or the supplier, whoever you're talking to, and look at you and your proposition from their perspective, and then address all the issues that will excite them but also will make them nervous. And in doing that, really start down a different conversation, different preparation, and in some cases a different proposition. So the other thing I learned about that is that I'm completely responsible for doing that, and I like to work with those elements where I have some control, particularly when you're taking risks. So even identifying what the risks are can be a proactive and positive thing to do.
I love that. It's a really, really powerful insight to take forward with you, and I think that's a good lesson for us all. And, you know, you talked about, you know, shifting from a lawyer, and you practiced commercial law for a decade before moving into that, as you call it, the adventure company. What triggered that shift in the first place? I mean, even that move in itself, and there's many more coming, which we'll get into, but why did you do it?
Yeah, I think it was really a crossroads for me where I'd been advising people for a long time on transactions and public company floats and fundraisings, and I loved it. And I thought, well, maybe I'm either going to keep advising on these things, which gives variety and it's intellectually stimulating, or I'm going to have a go myself. And I was, I was lured, if you like, by my own fascination with delivering on the advice that I'd been giving. And one of the really first things that stood out for me is that when you give advice, you can be strong in that advice, and you can give the spectrum of what the go forward positions are. You can be really solid on things that are written in legislation and those impacts, and you can be broad on risks that may not yet be well understood. But at the end of the day, the client still makes the decision, and they do that weighing up not just your legal advice but so many other elements that go into that decision-making, from the economics of it through to even the personal impacts of those decisions. And I was fascinated by that, and, boy, it's a wild ride when all of a sudden you are responsible for those decisions and you learn that it's 24/7 and the buck stops with you. Mm-hmm. And there are a whole lot of other learnings that came from that experience.
Wow. Now, you've had the confidence, we've been talking for a while, and that the confidence to change roles, change industries, change disciplines multiple times. I think there's at least 10 times in there, and over your career, you have the ability to ignore any sideline commentary of people questioning your decisions, and there have been questions about those at times. You mentioned that line, or that philosophy of having a healthy respect for failure. I'm really fascinated. I'm probably the polar opposite of you, Sally, and I would love to take more of a leaf out of your book. Is it something that people can learn? I can see the adventurous spirit from your parents. Is it something that people can learn? How can one cultivate that kind of orientation to become serial have-a-goers?
It's a good question, because I think there are elements of people who like change that are innate. That's that whole sort of nurture versus nature. But I do think you can learn it, and I think it just starts with little things. Set little challenges and start on that progression of learning, being comfortable with risk, and, as I said, being comfortable with some failures and humiliations along the way, and then build up that sense of resilience, personal resilience, and find the way that those challenges shape you and the way that you want to respond and go forward. Because, you know, a big part of change or taking risks is that sense of unknown that goes with it. I remember, and this is a personal story, we were living in London, two boys in their teens, and we were planning on spending some more time overseas. And the boys gave us a little presentation on why they both had enjoyed the experience there, but they did want to go home. And it was a completely compelling presentation that they gave us. And without even looking at each other, my partner Andrew and I both looked at them and said, okay, we'll go home. And then they looked back at us with a sort of a quizzical look and said,
would have thrown them.
Don't you have to check with somebody first? And we said, no, this is our life and we get to make these decisions and it will have consequences, but we'll work through those. But it's really important that, you know, we make decisions in our life. And for them, they couldn't believe it. They were expecting us to have to go through all sorts of processes or hurdles or ask other people. But at the end of the day, it was a family decision to come home, even if it wasn't always the best career decision for Andrew and I. But it was a really important time, and I think they learned a lot out of that in terms of really taking responsibility for your own life. And sometimes there are situations where the decisions are out of your control, but there'll always be elements within it that you can control or be proactive or really make your own decisions. And so I tend towards those situations. But it was a great learning for them, but it also was a really good it was a good emphasis for us on how important it is to feel that you've got options and to make your own decisions.
There's a lot I love about that, not least of which is the fact that your boys did a pitch to mum and dad. So I can't imagine my two kids pulling together a pitch like that. But I do love it. And I love that you demonstrated what empowerment looks like, and which is wonderful. You've picked up on a thread there that I'm interested to explore a bit further, Sally, and that's around change that happens outside of your control. And you mentioned a little earlier that you did go through a really difficult time in the fact that you had cancer in your 30s. You had a young family, two young sons at that time, and I can't imagine how difficult that would have been. What do you remember about that time? What are the things that stand out in your mind, particularly as somebody who is so drawn to focusing on the things that you can control? What was that time like?
Yeah. Well, I remember it vividly, of course, because we hadn't had any health issues in either side of our family. So we'd really been untouched in that way. And when the doctor said to me, you've got cancer, I think there are still so many unknowns, even though we've made such great strides forward with this disease and its many forms and this illness. There is still a lot of unknowns. So the C word to me, it was fear to my heart, and my first thoughts and emotions went to the children. And I can still get emotional about it today, being just so concerned about the impact on them and their future and that uncertainty. And it really, as I said, it really did strike me to my heart. So many things going on in your head intellectually, but very emotionally led in those initial stages, which can be difficult because there's so much to sort through. And look, at the end of the day, when we asked lots of questions and we worked through the detail, I had one of the best cancers you can hope to have, and a tumour that can be taken out and some treatment that eradicates it from your body, and life goes on. So I felt, again, an appreciation for and a sense of luck in terms of that, but it took a long time for the emotions to settle and to start thinking more clearly, and it's just the fear, it's absolute fear.
I can't imagine. What would you say were the big takeaways that you have forever carried forward from that time?
Yeah, it's a good question. And you mentioned empowerment earlier, and I think what's really important for me in my life, and I think for others, is to always feel that you've got options and you can make choices. When I was told I had cancer, of course, I immediately thought, well, this is it, that's the end. And I didn't have the knowledge or the information in those initial stages to feel that I had choices to make and that I could self-determine my future. I thought that was being done for me. And, of course, as conversations evolved and our knowledge grew, we realised we had lots of options. So I think really important is that sense of always looking for where you can find momentum to move forward. Mm. And look, there's a saying that I say to myself every day, and sometimes, Janelle, more than once a day, depending on what the circumstances are. And it's from a gentleman named Edward Hale from centuries ago. But it goes like this: I'm only one, but I am one. I cannot do everything, but I can do something, and I will not let what I cannot do interfere with what I can do. And it really centres me, and it gets me refocused on those things that I can do and that I can achieve. And even if they're tiny steps forward, I take that as a positive. And I use that momentum to keep going forward, because there are so many circumstances that I can't change, that I can't control. They're not my decisions to make, but they may still affect me. And I just remind myself that I am one. So it's important to remember that we've all got that power that is our own persona, that I can't possibly achieve everything, but there'll always be things that I can achieve. And I really do focus not on the roadblocks, but on the avenues to move forward. And that's been very helpful for me.
And I know you've mentioned that to me in the past, that quote, and I've been thinking about that a lot. It's just such an empowering, when you feel catatonic, if you feel like there is no move, just a tiniest step forward, or the realization that it might be only you, but it is you, you're still there, is really empowering. It makes me think of something that my last podcast interview was with Holly Ransom, who I know you know very well. And she made a statement that said, was along the lines of, the greatest gift in achieving change is momentum. And what you really talked about there is the creation of momentum. Now, however slight that might be, directionally it's forward, isn't it?
It is. And it's very powerful.
How difficult was that shift from a commercial mindset to serving local government? And what surprised you about making that transition, you know, whether it's on the upside or the downside?
Yeah, and of course there have been both.
Both.
And, you know, I'm still learning. In fact, one of my sort of rules as I've moved through my career is to always take with me, you know, the best of what I've learned, and that means I really try to make the most out of every role that I've had. I make the most of every experience. I wring it out like a sponge to make sure I've got the best of every possibility. And as I came into local government, I was pretty upfront on the fact that I'd never been in local government before. I've never been in an elected role before, but I did feel that my past experiences gave me a solid platform from which to bring the best of that experience, but also to keep growing and keep learning. And I think, of course, that's played out unbelievably, because the 3 years that I've been here, we've had, you know, massive cultural issues to deal with internally. That's the circumstances on which I came in. We've had a terrorist attack. We've had some horrible murders of young women. We've had massive bushfires in the country that we mobilised here in the city. And then, of course, we've had a pandemic. And during that time, we've had things like earthquakes, and it felt like a tornado last week as well. So it's been very eventful.
It really has all been happening.
Yeah, it's been very eventful, and it's really tested me. And I think part of that respect for other people is knowing that you build teams where you can bring the best of your skills, but you're also relying on the best of other people's skills. We don't come into roles being perfect at every part of that role. And so being very open about my strengths and weaknesses, and being very appreciative of other people's strengths and weaknesses, and frankly, working in environments where you're allowed to have weaknesses, all of those elements have been really important to me as I've come into this role. So I've used my legal background, I've used my commercial background, I've used my life experiences, and I've used the many roles that I've had to bring the best things I've learned along the way to value here in Town Hall, but be very open to learning from others where they've got knowledge and skills that can really enhance myself, who I am as a person, but also me as a leader of the city.
And Sally, you outlined a ton of different things that have happened, many of which we never saw coming, would never have hoped to be seeing coming. But notwithstanding the stuff that has just happened and we've had to navigate, is there an underpinning change agenda that you are trying to drive?
Yes. And, you know, in reflection, the change, some of that change agenda we are steering. Mm-hmm. In a proactive way, and some of that change agenda has obviously been thrust upon us, and there's a responsibility to learn from those situations to be better. I'm really a big fan of challenging to improve, so I love people challenging me and my thinking and my approaches on things on the basis that they're doing that to help improve the situation, and I challenge on that basis as well. And that's really important in both situations of change where you're leading it to change that's thrust upon you. I say that because just when you think you're in control of something, another twist will happen and you find that it's a different outcome than what you thought, or people have responded differently to how you'd anticipated, or something external happens that really knocks off an internal agenda. It's a daily occurrence, and I think being open to that and being able to move with those different rhythms has been something that over time has become sort of central to the way that I lead. I'm really open to all of those things. I'm happy to say I don't know. I'm happy to say I was wrong. I've had to say that publicly. And it's terrifying and it's humiliating, but if it's the right thing to do, you must do it. I think it's also been important for me in this role, which is a publicly elected role, to reflect the mood of the people I represent. At times that can be jubilance, and other times it can be fear and frustration. And it's important to acknowledge the reality of a situation, but then look to identify ways forward to create that momentum we talked about earlier. And I've also found that being vulnerable, being okay with mistakes and acting quickly to correct them means that people also find me very approachable. They share, maybe overshare sometimes, but they share things with me. I'm very accessible to people, and I find that really helps cut through issues more quickly, and it also helps to rally people when needed. So that's really become part of the hallmark of how I lead.
I love that. And speaking of reflecting the mood, I think you're quite right. It is important to reflect the mood. When I think about, you know, Melbourne CBD and how widely it's been impacted due to COVID-19, you know, lockdown. But what would you say the morale of Melbourne is like at the moment, and how do you help support and build that up?
Well, of course, when we look at this whole pandemic period and the roller coaster that we've been on, there have been some massive downs. And literally I think that's part of the pandemic dynamic, is that there have been so many elements that we just can't control, whether it's the way that the virus has moved and caused such a big health issue, to the way that different levels of government have responded, to the way that individuals have responded. All of these extreme situations have really led to days where there are so many things that have felt out of our control. I mean, let's face it, we've had a 9 o'clock curfew. We've had a 5-kilometre travel rule. It's quite extraordinary to think about what we've been through as the city that's had the most days in lockdown of any city in the world. But from that hardship also come some of the most astounding and impressive aspects of how we've responded as a community. On the whole, people have understood that their personal actions has a really big impact on the entire community. That's why we adhered to restrictions that none of us wanted, but we did it to help save people's lives, to help ensure that there was no burden on our health system and frontline workers. And we've done the most extraordinary job. I think people should look back with much pride in very difficult circumstances. So that sense of the ups and downs have been extreme, but for all of the very difficult situations, there have been the most incredible silver linings, you know, from how we've been able to work with the Victorian government to make sure our rough sleepers have had safe places to sleep and support services every day, a situation that previously had been thought too complex, too costly, too difficult to solve, and yet within a pandemic environment we were able to do it, align goals, share resources and actually make things happen. So it's been a time of extremes. And for all of the negatives, there have been just as many positives. And really now it's about capturing as much as we can of that positive, the positive outcomes and the positive approaches, and making sure that they're really helping drive that momentum as we move forward.
You mentioned rough sleepers there, which is a really important initiative you've been involved in. I know you've also devised a campaign called Project Slingshot, which promotes women in Melbourne and their stories. What were you hoping to achieve with that campaign?
Yeah, I love that word slingshot. You've reminded me, I've got to use it more often. It really goes to that sense of pace, doesn't it? And that if we want to change...
Very action-oriented.
Yeah, if we want to change the status quo, there's obviously a different paces at which we can do that. We can do it in small little steps, or we can take big strides forward, and different situations demand different approaches. But on things like equity and fairness and equality, whether that's for women or other vulnerable groups within the community, I think that a slingshot approach, that sense of pace and scale, those big strides forward, are really important. And we've shown through COVID how we can have, even in the immediacy and the urgency of the crisis, we can still have that dedication to progress on really big issues that we've been tackling for time. And if we can use this period as a slingshot for some of those big challenges and conundrums, then I think we should. And that's really been a focus for things like, as I said, equity and inclusion, for affordable housing, or just housing first, full stop, and also for our response to climate change as key themes where we've had a dedication to progress, even during these extreme pandemic times.
Now, in 2019, you were awarded, I mentioned this in the intro, you were awarded the McKinnon Emerging Political Leader of the Year Prize. And that was specific to your leadership of the Melbourne City Council, where you were noted for your presence in town hall, where you fostered a high degree of consensus amongst councillors for advancing an impactful policy agenda. So clearly, when I look at that, I think, well, you've learned a thing or two about understanding the different perspectives of stakeholders and finding the common ground from which to drive change. From your perspective, how were you operating to get that kind of result and recognition?
Well, firstly, I hadn't been an emerging anything for a long time, Janelle, so I was absolutely thrilled to get the Emerging Political Leader Award.
Yeah, I really do think that it is important to recognise that, and I'm glad you are. I still think you're being a little humble in there. In getting that, what do you remember about the way you were operating?
Yes, yes.
That got that kind
back
of
to your real question, Janelle. Thank you for being very polite. Well, look, I'm a collaborator and I am a consensus builder by nature. It's my approach. It's sort of fundamental to who I am. And absolutely key to that is persistence. Mm-hmm. There are so many times when a door is closed or somebody says it's too hard or they don't want to play along. Certainly here, there was a huge amount of turmoil at the time that I came in as Lord Mayor. That was following a situation where the former Lord Mayor had been involved in sexual harassment claims, and really it was raw, and there were a lot of emotions, and there was a real desire to move forward, but still embroiled so much in investigations and I guess a defence of what had been happening at the time, that it was hard for people to really find a way forward. So I think being somebody new was certainly helpful because I could come in and cut through. And I've got to say, I made some mistakes at the start as well, where I came in and I thought, oh, okay, I'm being really honest now, Janelle, that
yes, please.
It was a situation where people were looking for strong leadership and that I had to make some early decisions and really, you know, show my mark on the organisation and how I was going to be as a leader. I came in and I made a couple of decisions on relatively small things that were happening here at Town Hall, and I realised pretty quickly that that's not what people needed. They needed kindness and care. They needed a sense of understanding of the emotional toll that the situation had taken on them as both councillors and staff. And they needed a leader who was going to show that care and interest whilst being strong. So it wasn't that I needed to make all those decisions on day one. It was a time for listening, a time for people to recover from the trauma, and to find a consensus for a new way forward, which I was uniquely placed to do, given that I hadn't been here through the circumstances. And so having made those early decisions and seeing the look on people's faces of shock and, frankly, exhaustion, to have somebody sort of coming in over the top and declaring certain things without having a true understanding of the situation was the wrong thing to do. And I do think this is a really important part of leadership as people go along their journeys, is that when you make a decision, well, you're expected to make decisions as a leader, but when you make a decision and you realise it's the wrong one, make another decision really quickly and keep moving forward. And as I indicated earlier, I'm quite comfortable to say when I've been wrong and to look to a different way forward. And so that's what we've done here. It's a big journey of healing, and that comes from acknowledging what the challenges were, what the reality is, and then, as I said, identifying different ways forward. And it's actually been a big part of what I've learned being involved with our traditional owners and traditional custodians here in Melbourne, is very much that sense of truth-telling and being able to acknowledge, because without acknowledging the reality, how do you move forward with confidence that you can deliver a new reality? And to me, it seems so basic now when I look back. I mean, strategy 101 is the first thing you've got to do is identify the reality of a situation to be able to put initiatives and strategies in place to deal with that. And if you don't, you've really just got a whole lot of wheels spinning and no traction. So that sense of identifying the reality but having some solutions to test and to try and hopefully to deliver is really important.
Thanks for that example. I feel like it's a really honest story of your own assumption of what a strong decision maker looks like. I could hear the desk thumping there.
Yeah.
And, you know, the indication that, oh, okay, well, I need to hit my fist, not that you did that in real life, but, you know, hit my fist on the table, make a decision with, you know, with confidence and with pace. And actually a strong decision maker can still show up with kindness, with listening.
Exactly.
Slowing down to make that decision. So it's a really interesting example of an assumption of what that looks like as a persona versus what actually was being sought. I love that. Sally, I've got one final question before I move to the fast three. If you had any advice for younger people, particularly young women starting out in their careers, what would it be?
It would be to really embrace pushing your own boundaries. There are so many people I see go through life in a straitjacket, and I like to think of people doing star jumps. But it's difficult to push or expect others to push organisational or structural or policy boundaries if you are not willing to do that to yourself internally. And I think really questioning yourself and pushing yourself and pushing through those personal boundaries that we all have. Mine have extended over time, I'm pleased to say, with lots of those failures and humiliations. But I really think we've got to take responsibility for pushing our own boundaries before we can expect others to do the same. And so I really like to start getting people focused on taking responsibility for their lives and how they proceed. And if you do that, it gives you more of that sense of ownership and empowerment.
Love it, and I certainly feel energised to be doing exactly that myself.
The last three fast questions on change to finish the podcast.
Final fast three for you, Sally. What are you reading, watching or listening to right now?
Oh, gosh, reading. I've got about 20 books on my bedside table, and it ranges from Mayors That Change the World, which is looking at the role of cities in how the world is changing, to Hillary Clinton's first attempt at fiction and, State of Terror, I think the book is called, and I can't wait to get into it. But I really read a lot, and I find it a great escape as well as a great education.
Wow, I'll have to get a photo snapshot of your bedside reading table so we can share that.
Yeah.
What's your superpower? Now, this can be something that's additive to the world, or it can be, I'm equally interested in a useless party trick.
Oh, how good. Well, I can do a three-leaf clover with my tongue, but I don't think that is my superpower. And I'm sorry that you've now got that image that you can probably never take back.
You can't take it away now. I'm happy to leave it.
I think my superpower is it's almost an unquenchable, unstoppable energy that I feel so lucky. I seem to have constant releases of dopamine and energy, and I feel so lucky to have that because it just means I'm always up for something, I'm always interested, and I'm always happy to put in the hard work, and I feel lucky to have so much energy.
Oh, I wasn't sure there was going to be much to top the three-leaf clover trick, but boundless energy is definitely going to take it. If you were going to put a quote up on a billboard, and perhaps you've already given it to us earlier, what would it be?
Yeah, well, that's the quote that I say every day. And, you know, I think it can be really shortened to, you know, focus every day on the areas where you can make a difference and don't slip into the vortex of that sense of hopelessness that comes when you're faced with all of the things. Let's face it, every day everybody has situations that they can't control or they don't like or that are difficult, but we're also faced every day with those situations where we can make a difference and a contribution. So I think it really is about making the most of every day and focusing on those areas where you can make a difference.
Oh, Sally, thank you so much for your time today. I've thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. Massive amount of takeaways for me, whether it's, you know, focusing, as you've just said, on what you can control. I love that, you derive from that a sense of achievement. It helps unlock inertia. It creates momentum. And you opened by saying that you are a glass all the way full person. And that is very, very evident to me. Even with the simple things of your reframing, whether it's, you know, from a pivot to a pirouette or a venture company to an adventure company, there's a clear reframing of positivity and can do about the way that you operate. I love that you believe that you should always take with you the best of every experience. And considering how many experiences you have had and you continue to take forward, it blows my mind how many positive things you've taken forward and the wealth of knowledge and depth you've built up. You've shown us so many examples of the power of your persistence, and the other side of that coin of persistence is resilience to me. And so the resilience that you have shown through your words, the humiliations, the setbacks to keep going has been amazing. Just that serial have-a-goer-ness about you, you live and breathe it. And I love your challenge to push the boundaries, to ditch the straitjacket, to embrace the star jump. I'm all in. Thanks for energizing me and everybody who's listened to this.
Thank you for having me today. It's been lovely, and thanks for listening to some of my story.
The Change Happens podcast from EY, a conversation on leading through change. Discover more where you get your podcasts.